Chapter 24 Darkmoor. Kalis studied the gem. He was so engrossed in it, he almost failed to notice the appearance of four figures in the great hall of the oracle. He glanced at the oracle's attendants, and as they displayed no distress, he assumed there was no danger. He looked at the new arrivals, and saw his father, resplendent in his white and gold armour, standing beside Nakor, Sho Pai, and a man dressed in the raiment of a monk of Aishap. Kalis forced himself away from studying the gem and rose to greet them. "Father," he said, hugging Tomas. Then he shook hands with Nakor. Nakor said, "This is Dominic. He is the abbot at Sarth. I thought he would prove useful to have with us." Kalis nodded. Tomas asked, "You were engrossed in the gem when we arrived." Kalis said,
"I'm seeing things in it, father."
Tomas said, "We need to talk." He glanced at the others and said, "But first I must pay my respects." He crossed to the great recumbent dragon, paused next to the gigantic head, and gently touched it. "Well met, old friend," he said softly. Then he turned to the senior-most of her companions and said, "Is she well?" The old man bowed slightly.
"She dreams, and in her dreams she relives a thousand lives, sharing them with the soul who will occupy that great body after her."
He motioned to a young boy who came to stand before Tomas.
"As I do with my replacement."
Tomas nodded. "Most ancient of races, we have transported you from one doom to another."
"There is risk," said the old man, "but there is purpose. We know that much."
Tomas nodded and returned to Kalis and the others. Dominic looked past Tomas with wide eyes.
"I never would have believed."
Nakor laughed.
"No matter what I see, I never imagine I've seen it all. The universe offers endless surprises."
Kalis said, "How is it you all managed to arrive together?"
"Long story," said Nakor.
He produced a Surani transportation globe and said,
"Not many of these left. Should get some more."
Kalis smiled. "Unfortunately, the rift to Kelawan is on Stardock, and last I looked, it's now firmly in the hands of Kesh."
"Not so firmly," said Nakor with a grin.
"What do you mean?" asked Kalis. Nakor shrugged.
"Pug asked me to think of something, so I did."
"What?" asked Tomas.
"I'll tell you when we survive this coming ordeal, and the fate of Stardock has some meaning."
Tomas said,
"Kalis, what did you mean about seeing things in the gem?"
Kalis looked at his father in surprise and asked,
"Can't you see them?"
Tomas turned his attention to the Lifestone, an artifact he knew in some ways more intimately than any living being on Midkamia. He let his mind relax and watched the cool green surface, and after a moment saw a pulsing light, faint and hard to apprehend if one tried too hard. After a moment he said,
"I see no images."
"Odd," said Kalis. "They were apparent to me the first few moments I looked at it."
"What do you see?" asked Nakor.
Kalis said, "I don't know if I have words, but I think I'm seeing the true history of this world." Nakor sat on the floor.
"Oh, this is most interesting. Please, tell me what you think you see."
Kalis sat as if to compose his thoughts. Suddenly, Pug and Miranda appeared. Tomas welcomed his old friend and Miranda, motioning for them to sit.
"What is it?" asked Pug.
Tomas said,
"Kalis is about to tell us what he sees in the Lifestone."
Kalis glanced to Miranda and to Pug, and for a moment he held the magician's gaze. Then he smiled.
"I'm pleased to see you both again."
Miranda returned his smile.
"As we are to see you."
Kalis said, "I must speak of the Lifestone." Nakor turned to Shopai and said,
"Memorize every word, if you want to continue bearing the mantle of disciple."
"Yes, master."
Kalis said, "The Lifestone is Midkamia, in the purest form. A reflection of all life that has gone before, is now, or will be, from the dawn until the end of time." All fell silent as Kalis considered his words. "At the beginning, there was nothing, and then came the universe. Pug and my father bore witness to that creation, as I have heard the story." He smiled at his father several times. "When the universe was born, it was aware, but in a fashion so far beyond what we comprehend that we have no adequate concepts to understand that awareness."
Nakor grinned. "It is like ants carrying food to their nest, while overhead a dragon sits atop a mountain. The ants have no concept of the dragon."
Kalis said, "More, but that is not an entirely faulty comparison. This awareness is more than any of us, all of us together, could comprehend. It is so vast and so timeless." He paused. "I don't think I can say more about it. When Midkamia was formed, it was home to powers, basic forces of nature. Mindless, they were forces that built up and tore down."
"Ratha and Maitha," said Tomas, "the two blind gods of creation."
"As good a name for those forces as any," agreed Nakor.
Kalis said, "Then came a reordering of things. Consciousness arose, and the beings that were mindless became purposeful. It is we who define the gods, in a fashion that makes sense to us. But they are so much more than this. The order of the universe is like a gem with many facets, and we see only one, that which reflects the existence of our own world."
Pug said, "It's shared with other worlds?"
"Oh, yes," said Kalis softly, "with all worlds. This is one of the key reasons why what we do here has a profound bearing upon every other world in the cosmos. It is the primal struggle between that which we label good and that which we call evil, and it exists in every corner of creation." He turned to look at the others in the great cave and said,
"I could speak for hours, so let me distill what I think I have discovered." Kalis composed his thoughts, then continued. "The Valharu were more than just the first race to live on Midkamia. They were a bridge between immortal and mortal. They were the first experiment, if you will, of the gods."
"Experiment?" said Pug.
"What kind of an experiment?" "I don't know," said Kalis. "I can't even be certain what I'm saying is true, only that it feels true."
Nakor said, "It's true."
All eyes turned toward the little Isalani. He grinned.
"It makes sense."
Pug said, "What makes sense?" Nakor said,
"Has anyone besides me wondered why we think?"
As the question came seemingly from out of the blue, everyone exchanged astonished glances. Pug laughed.
"Not recently, no.
We think because the gods have given us the power of apprehension, said Dominic.
Nacor shook his finger at the abbot.
You know that's dogma, and you know the gods are as much the creation of mankind as mankind is the creation of the gods.
Pug asked, So, then, what is your point?
Oh, just wondering, said Nacor. I was thinking of that story you told me, about when you and Thomas went to find Makros, and you saw the creation of the universe.
And? Asked Thomas.
Well, began Nacor, it seems to me you have to begin at the beginning.
Pug stared at the little man and burst out laughing. Within seconds, everyone was laughing.
See, said Nacor, humor is a property of intelligence.
All right, Nacor, said Miranda. What are you talking about? Nacor said,
Something started it all.
Yes, said Dominic. There was a primal urge. A creator. Something.
Suppose, said Nacor, it was a self-creation.
The universe just decided to awake one day, asked Miranda. Nacor pondered the question a moment.
There is something, I think, we should always keep in mind. Everything we talk about is limited by our own perceptions, our own ability to understand, in short, by our very nature.
True, agreed Pug.
So, to say the universe woke up one day is perhaps, at one and the same time, the most apt and the most incomplete way of putting it, said Nacor.
Dominic said,
This sort of debate is common in the courts of the church. The exercises in logic and faith can often be frustrating.
But I think we have something here few of your brothers have, Abbot, said Nacor. Eyewitnesses to creation.
If that is what they saw, said Dominic.
Ah,
said Nacor, and he could barely contain his glee.
We cannot be sure about anything, can we?
What is reality is a common question in those moot courts I spoke of, said the abbot.
Reality is what you bump into in the dark, said Miranda dryly. Nacor laughed, then he said,
You've talked about this big ball thing blowing up to make the universe, right?
Pug nodded.
So, what if everything was inside that ball?
We assume it was, said Pug.
Well, what was outside the ball?
We were, said Pug quickly, and the garden and the city forever.
But you come from within that big ball, said Nacor.
And as the others watched, he stood and began to pace, animated by being on the brink of understanding.
I mean, you were born ages into the future from the creation, but from stuff inside the ball, if you see.
What about the city forever? Asked Miranda.
Maybe it was created far in the future. What do you think?
By whom? Asked Pug. Nacor shrugged.
I don't know. And for the moment, I don't care. Maybe, when you're 1,000 years old, you're the one who makes the city forever and sends it back to the dawn of time, so you and Makros have some place to sit to watch the universe being born.
Baby universes and 1,000-year-old magicians, said Dominic, obviously trying to be patient and losing the attempt.
Nacor held up his hand.
Why not? We know travelling through time is possible. Which brings up, what is time?
They all glanced at one another, and each began to answer, but soon all fell silent.
Time is time, said Dominic. It marks the passage of events.
No, said Nakor. Humans mark the passage of events. Time doesn't care. Time just is. But what is it?
He wore a delighted grin as he answered his own question.
Time is what keeps everything from happening at once.
Pug's eyebrows rose. So in the ball, everything was happening at once.
And then the universe changed, said Nakor with glee.
Why? Asked Miranda. Nakor shrugged.
Who knows? It just did. Pug, you told me when you found Macross this last time. He had begun to merge with Sarig. Was he Macross, or was he Sarig?
Both, for a short while, but he was still mostly Macross.
I wish I could ask him. As you were merging, did you lose your sense of being Macross?
For a moment, Nakor looked genuinely regretful, but then his grin returned as he said,
I think it's safe to say that the more you become one with a god, the less you stay you.
Then I understand, said Dominic. What? Asked Miranda. What this madman is driving at? The old abbot put his finger to his head. Mind. The spirit of the gods. The everything he talks about as stuff. If everything was occurring at once, before this creation, then everything was everything. No differentiation.
Yes, said Nakor,
delighted at the abbot's observations. So, for reasons we will never know, the totality of creation acted to differentiate itself. This birth of the universe was a means for the universe. The abbot's eyes widened. It was the universe attempting to become conscious. Thomas's eyes narrowed.
I don't follow. Humans are conscious, as are other intelligent races, and the gods are conscious. But the universe is... It is, that's all. No, said Nakor. Why humans? Why other thinking creatures?
I don't know, said Pug. Nakor's expression turned serious.
Because becoming mortal is the means by which the universe, this stuff I talk about, becomes self-conscious, self-aware. Each life is the universe's experiment, and each of us brings back knowledge to the universe when we die. Macross attempted to become one with a god, and learned that the further you get from mortality, the further you stray from that self-consciousness. Lesser gods are more detached from self than mortals. Greater gods even more so, I wager.
Dominic nodded. The tier of the gods allows the order to communicate with the greater gods. It is a very difficult task. We rarely attempt it, and when we do, often the communications are incomprehensible. The old abbot sighed. The tear is a valuable gift, for it lets us work the magic that proves to those who serve us that Aishap is still living, so we can worship and work toward his return. But the nature of the gods, even that one we worship, is far beyond our ability to know.
Nakor laughed. Very well. Now, if this universe was born the day Macross, Pug, and Thomas were watching, what does that say about the universe?
I don't know, admitted Pug.
It's a baby, said Nakor.
Pug laughed. He couldn't help himself. The universe is several billion years old, by my calculations. Nakor shrugged.
That may be a 2-year-old universe, for all we know. What if it is?
What's the point? Said Miranda. Thomas said,
Yes, while all this is fascinating, we still have some problems to solve.
Nakor said,
True, but the more we know about what it is we're involved with, the more we have a chance of solving those problems.
Agreed, but where to begin?
I asked earlier, why do we think? I may have some idea.
Nakor paused, then continued.
Suppose, for a moment, the universe, everything in it, and everything that ever was or will be, is linked.
We share something in common? Asked Dominic.
No, more than that. We are all the same.
Looking at Pug and Miranda, Nakor said,
You call it magic. I call it tricks.
To Dominic, he said,
You call it prayer. But it's all the same thing. And what it is...
Yes, prompted Pug.
That's where I run into a problem. I don't know what it is. I call it stuff.
He sighed.
It's some sort of basic thing. Something that everything is made up of.
You might have called it spirit, suggested Dominic. You might have called it laundry, said Miranda dryly. Nakor laughed.
Whatever it is, we're all part of it, and it's part of us.
Pug was silent for a moment. This is maddening. I feel as if I'm almost at the edge of understanding something, but it's just outside my grasp. And what does this have to do with putting things right?
Everything. Nothing. I don't know, said Nakor agreeably. It's just something I was thinking of.
Tomas said,
Much of what you say echoes things I knew once, when I was one with Ashen Shugar.
Nakor said,
I think so. The universe is alive, a being of impossible complexity and vastness. It is, for want of a better term, a god. Maybe the god. I don't know.
Macross called it the ultimate, said Tomas.
That's good, said Nakor. The ultimate god. The one above all, as the Aishapians call Aishap.
But you're not talking of Aishap, said Dominic.
No. He's an important god, but he's not the ultimate. I don't think this ultimate even has a name. He just is.
Nakor sighed.
Can you imagine a being with stars in its head? Billions of them? We have blood and bile. It has worlds and comets and intelligent races. Everything.
Nakor was obviously excited by the image, and Pug glanced at Miranda, seeing her smile reflecting his own amusement at the strange little man's pleasure.
The ultimate, if you will, knows everything, is everything. But he's a baby. How do babies learn?
Pug, who had raised his children, said,
They watch. They are corrected by their parents. They mimic.
But, interrupted Nakor, if you're God, and there's no Mama God or Papa God, how do you learn?
Miranda was caught up in the discourse and began to laugh.
I have no idea.
You experiment, said Dominic.
Yes,
said Nakor, and his grin became even wider.
You try things. You create things, like people, and you turn them loose to see what happens.
Miranda said, So where's some sort of cosmic puppet theatre?
No, said Nakor. God isn't watching us on a celestial stage. Because God is also the puppets.
I'm completely lost, admitted Pug.
We're back to why we think, explained Nakor. If God is everything, mind, spirit, thought, action, dirt, wind.
He glanced at Miranda.
Laundry, everything that is and can be. Then each thing he is must be accounted for as having a purpose. What is life for? He asked rhetorically. It's a way to evolve thought. And what is thought for? It's a way to be aware, a stage between the physical and the spiritual. And time, it's a good way to keep things separated. And lastly, why humans and elves and dragons and other thinking creatures?
Dominic said, so that spirit can be self-conscious?
Nakor said,
right.
He looked to be on the verge of doing a dance.
Each time one of us goes to Lim's Kragma's Hall, we're sharing our life experience with God. Then we go back and do it again, over and over.
Miranda didn't look convinced. So you're saying we live in a universe where evil is just as much this god's fault as good?
Yes, said Nakor, because God doesn't see it as good or evil. God's learning about good and evil. To him, it's just the odd way certain creatures behave.
Seems he's slow, said Pug dryly.
No, he's vast, insisted Nakor. He's doing this over and over a billion, billion times a day on a billion worlds.
Tomas said,
at one time, Pug and I asked Macross what the point was if we live in a universe this vast, this complex. Should one little planet succumb to the Valheru? He told us the nature of the universe changed after the Chaos Wars, and that a reemergence of the Valheru into Midkamia would change the order of things.
I think not, said Nakor. I mean it would be a very unhappy situation for everyone on Midkamia. But eventually the universe would right itself. God is learning. Of course, billions of people could die before something happened to set things right again.
Miranda said, you make it all sound so pointless.
If you look at it that way, yes, said Nakor. But I like to think the point is, we're teaching God to do the correct thing. We're correcting a baby. And that good is worth struggling for. That kindness is better than hatred. That creation is better than destruction. And many other things as well.
Anyway, said Pug, it's far more of an academic question to the people living in the kingdom. Kalis said, Nakor's right. All eyes returned to Kalis. He's just made it possible for me to understand what it is that is being done and why I'm here. Miranda asked, why? Kalis smiled. I need to unlock the Lifestone. Eric drank deeply. The wine was a chilled white, a variety common to this part of the duchy.
Thank you,
he said as he put down the flagon. Prince Patrick, Owen Greylock, and Manfred von Darkmoor sat at a table with Eric. Around the room stood a half dozen other nobles, some dressed like court dandies, and others as dirty and blood-soaked as Eric. Patrick said, you've done well considering the rapidity with which Krondor fell.
Thank you, Highness, said Eric.
Greylock said,
I just wish we had more time to prepare.
Patrick said, there's never enough time. We must trust that we've done enough so that we can hold them here at Darkmoor. A messenger hurried in, saluted, and handed a message to Greylock. He opened it and said,
ill news. The southern reserves are overrun.
Overrun?
Said Patrick, slamming the table in frustration.
They were supposed to be cleverly hidden away, ready to strike at the enemy and bleed them from behind. What happened?
Owen handed the scroll to the prince, but he said for the benefit of the others in the room,
Kersh, she's moved her army just south of Dorgin. The enemy's southern wing was being pinched too tightly, and when they ran into the Keshians on one flank and the dwarves ahead, they turned north and overran our fortification.
Kersh has taken a hand? Asked a tired-looking old noble, whom Eric didn't recognize.
It was to be expected, said Patrick.
If we survive this war, we'll worry about Kesh after.
What of Lord Sutherland? Asked the noble.
The Duke of the Southern Marches is dead. Gregory, as well as the Earl of Landreth, died in the fighting. My lords, if this report is accurate, for all intents and purposes, the Southern reserves no longer exist, said Greylock.
One of the fancily dressed nobles said, Perhaps we should consider falling back to Malak's Cross, Highness.
The prince threw the man a withering look, but refused to dignify the suggestion with a comment. Looking at Eric, he said, Those of you just in, please follow the squires outside to your quarters. You'll find fresh clothing and a bath waiting. I'll be pleased to dine with you in an hour's time. He rose, and the others followed suit. We'll continue this discussion at dawn tomorrow. We'll have more intelligence by then. He turned and left the room. After the prince had departed, Manfred motioned to Eric and Owen to move away from the door.
Well, we have an awkward situation, it seems, gentlemen.
Eric nodded.
I understood what I was in for the moment I crossed the drawbridge.
Owen said, We are the prince's men, may I remind your lordship? Manfred waved away the comment.
Tell that to my mother.
Then he gave a rueful smile.
Better yet, don't.
Eric said,
We can't conduct the business of war while attempting to avoid your mother, Manfred.
Eric has that right, said Owen. Manfred sighed.
Very well.
Owen, I've instructed our current swordmaster to turn your old quarters back over to you. I thought you might be more comfortable there. And, truth to tell, it's getting a little bit crowded around here.
Owen smiled. I bet Percy's not happy.
Your former assistant was never a happy man. He was born with a long face. Turning to Eric, Manfred said, You'll stay in a room near mine. The closer you are to me, the less likely Mother is to send someone after you.
Eric looked dubious. Duke James tried to reason with her.
No one reasons with Mother. I suspect you'll find that out before this night is through. Now, let me show you to your quarters. Turning to Greylock, he said, Owen, I'll see you at supper.
My lord, said Owen.
The three left the conference hall, and while Owen went one way, Manfred took Eric another.
This castle is quite large, said Manfred. It's easy to get lost. If you do, ask any servant where to go.
I don't know how long I'll stay, said Eric. Owen and the prince haven't told me what my next position's to be. I replaced Kaelis in the fallback, but now that phase is over.
I suspect something similar, said Eric's half-brother. It appears you've done quite well. He glanced around the ancient halls of Darkmoor Castle. I hope I acquit myself as well when the time comes.
You will, said Eric.
They walked around a corner, and Eric almost stumbled. Coming along the corridor was a stately procession, an older woman in regal raiment, followed by two guards and several lady companions. She stopped for a moment when she saw Manfred, but when she recognized Eric, her eyes grew enormous.
You,
she said with a near hiss of contempt.
It's the bastard! The murderous bastard!
She turned to the nearest guard and said,
Kill him!
The stunned guard looked from Matilda, mother of the Baron, to Manfred, who motioned with his hand for the guard to step away. The guard nodded to the Baron and stepped back. Manfred said, Mother, we've been all over that. Eric has a pardon from the king. Whatever has gone before is over.
Never,
said the old woman, with a hatred that surprised Eric. He had imagined her distaste for him, from the years when his mother demanded Eric's father acknowledge him to the murder of her son. but never had he experienced anything like this firsthand. Of all the men he had faced in battle, none had regarded him with the pure, naked hatred Matilda von Darkmoor revealed in her eyes.
"Mother," said Manfred, "that's enough. I'm ordering you to desist."
The woman turned her gaze upon her son, and Eric saw instantly that her hatred wasn't limited to Eric alone. She stepped forward, and for an instant Eric feared she would strike her son. In a strident whisper, she said,
"You order me."
She looked her son up and down.
"If you were the man your brother was, you'd have killed this murdering bastard before he got away. If you were even half as much a man as your father, you'd have married and had a son by now, and this bastard's claim would mean nothing. Do you want him to kill you? Do you want to lie in the dirt while this killer takes your title? Do you—"
"Mother!" Manfred roared.
"Enough!"
He turned to the guards and said, "Escort my mother to her quarters." He told his mother, "If you can compose yourself, dine with us tonight. But if you can't maintain a shred of dignity before Prince Patrick, do us the courtesy of dining in your room. Now go!" Manfred turned and began walking, and Eric followed, but he glanced over his shoulder. She never took her eyes from him, and each step of the way, Eric knew the old woman wished him dead. Eric was so intent on the woman, he almost knocked Manfred down when he turned the corner. Manfred said, "Sorry about that, Eric."
I understand,
Mother. You'd be the first." He waved for Eric to follow and said, "Your room is down here at the end of the hall." When he opened the door and Eric entered, Manfred followed. "I picked this one for two reasons," said Manfred. He pointed to the window. "It's a quick exit. And this is one of the few rooms in Darkmoor that doesn't have a secret passage leading to it."
"Secret passage?"
"Quite a lot of them, really," Manfred said. "This castle was enlarged several times since the original Baron built the first tower keep. There had been some quick exits should the castle fall. Then some additional rooms added, with back passages, so the Lord could visit his favourite servant in the middle of the night. Some of them serve a useful purpose, so servants can move through the castle without getting underfoot. But for the most part, they're deserted old byways, useful for those who wish to spy on their neighbours, or for assassins." Eric sat down on a chair in the corner.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome," said Manfred. "If I may suggest a bath and change of clothing, I'll have the servants fetch you some water straight away. The clothes in the wardrobe should fit." He grinned. "They were father's." Eric said, "Do you delight in upsetting your mother?" Manfred's face took on an edge of anger. "More than you'll ever know." Eric sighed. "I thought about some of the things you said about Stefan when you came to visit me in jail. I guess I never appreciated how hard it must be for you." Manfred laughed. "You'll never know. Do you mind if I ask you something?"
"What?"
"Why does she hate you? I know why she hates me, but she looked at you the same way." Manfred said, "That, brother, is something I may or may not choose to disclose some day. But for the time being, let us just say that Mother has never appreciated the way I choose to live my life. As the second son, who would not inherit, it was only a source of some slight conflict. Since Stefan's demise, the tension has increased significantly."
"Sorry to have asked."
"That's all right. I can appreciate why you'd be curious." Manfred turned toward the door. "And sometime I may just tell you. Not because you have any right to know,
but because it would make Mother supremely unhappy if I did. With what Eric considered an evil smile, Manfred left the room. Eric sat back, waiting for the servants to bring his bath water. He had dozed off when they knocked. Sleepily he rose and opened the door, and a half dozen servants entered, carrying buckets of steaming water and a large metal tub. He allowed the two men who had carried the tub inside to remove his boots for him, while the others filled it. Sitting in the hot water made Eric feel as if every ache and pain was going to fade away. He lay back a moment, then suddenly sat bolt upright as one of the servants began to wash him.
"Is anything wrong, my lord?"
"I'm not a lord. You can call me captain, and I can bathe myself," said Eric, taking the washing cloth and soap from the man. "That'll be all.
Shall we lay out clothing before we go?"
"Oh, yes, that'd be fine," said Eric, now fully awake.
The other servants left, while the one who had spoken selected clothing from the wardrobe.
"Shall I fetch boots, Captain?"
"No, I'll wear my own."
"I'll try to clean them before you leave, sir."
He was out of the door with them before Eric could object. Eric shrugged and started washing in earnest. He had rarely had the luxury of a hot bath, and as the water cooled, he found himself reviving. He knew that as soon as supper was over, unless the prince demanded more meetings, he was going to turn in and sleep the sleep of the dead. Then he reconsidered that image and decided he'd sleep lightly, even with the door barred. Eric had no idea of the time, but decided he didn't want to be late for dinner with the Prince of Krondor. He dried himself off and inspected the clothing chosen for him by the servant. The man had laid out a pair of pale yellow leggings, a light blue tunic, and a stylish cloak of very light grey, almost white. Eric decided to leave aside the cloak and don the hose and tunic. Just as he was finishing, the servant opened the door and said,
"Your boots, Captain."
Eric was astonished. In a few minutes, the man had managed to get all the blood and filth off and return the leather to a passable shine.
"Thank you," said Eric as he took the boots.
The servant said, "Shall I have the bathtub removed while you dine?"
"Yes," said Eric as he donned his boots.
The servant departed, and Eric ran his hand over his chin. He wished for a razor and some soap, and supposed that had he asked for them, they would have been provided, but he hadn't. So he decided some whiskers were preferable to keeping the Prince of Krondor waiting. He went out into the hall and around the corner to where he had left the council room, and found a pair of guards standing at the door to that chamber. He asked directions to the dining hall, and the guard saluted and said,
"Follow me, Captain."
He did so, and the man led him through a series of passages to what Eric expected was part of the original keep, or a series of rooms added soon after, for the dining hall was surprisingly intimate. There was a square table with room for a dozen diners aside, but the walls were only a few feet behind each of them. So if too many people attempted to move at the same time, things could become quite tangled. Eric nodded to several of the nobles he had met at Krondor, and was pointedly ignored by several others who were deep in private conversations. Owen was already there, and indicated he should come and sit next to him. Eric moved around the table and saw the three seats on the right next to Greylock were empty.
Greylock said, "Take this one,"
indicating the seat on his left. He patted the seat on his right and said,
"This is the prince's."
Then Eric noticed every noble at the table was watching him, and suddenly he felt embarrassed. Dukes and earls, barons and squires, all were seated below him at the table. He knew that where one sat in relationship to the prince
had serious implications in matters of court intrigue, and he suddenly wished he had thought to take the chair opposite the prince, at the farthest table on the other side of the room. A few minutes later, the door behind them opened, and Eric turned to see Prince Patrick enter. He rose, as did the other nobles, and they all bowed their heads. Then came Baron Manfred, their host, followed by his mother. The prince took his place at the center of the head table, and Manfred moved to his right hand. Matilda moved to her chair, but when she saw Eric, she said, "I will not sit at the same table as my son's murderer," Manfred said. "Then, madam, you shall dine alone." With a nod of his head, he ordered the guards to escort his mother from the hall. She turned and silently left with her escort. Several of the nobles in attendance spoke softly to one another until the prince pointedly cleared his throat.
"Shall we begin?" he asked.
Manfred bowed his head, and the prince sat. The others followed suit. The food was splendid, and the wine was the best Eric had ever tasted, but fatigue made it hard for him to keep alert. Still, the discussions around him were all important, for men spoke about the coming fight. At one point, someone observed that the northern flank was holding so well, it might prove wise to send for some of their soldiers to reinforce Darkmoor. The prince overheard the remark and said, "That wouldn't be wise. We can't assume they won't return there in force the next day." Discussion around the table turned to speculation about the coming fight, and after a while, Prince Patrick said, "Captain von Darkmoor, you, more than any man here, have fought the enemy. What can we expect?" Every eye in the room turned toward Eric. He glanced at Greylock, who gave him a slight nod. Eric cleared his throat and said, "We can expect between 150 and 175,000 soldiers to arrive outside the city walls and along the entire length of Nightmare Ridge."
"When?"
asked one richly dressed court dandy. "Any time," answered Eric. "As early as tomorrow." The man went pale at the news and said,
"Perhaps, Highness, we should call up the Army of the East. They're only camped down in the hills to the east."
Patrick said, "The Army of the East will be called when I decide it's time." He glanced at Eric. "What sort of men do we face?" Eric knew the prince had read every report sent back by Kaelis on his three trips to Nevindus, during his grandfather Aruta's reign, during his uncle Nicholas's reign, and the last time. He had also spoken to the prince on this very subject no less than 5 times, so Eric knew he was asking for the benefit of those nobles in the room who were untested in battle. Eric glanced at Greylock, who again gave him a faint nod and a slight smile. Eric knew Owen well enough to understand what he was being asked to do. Eric cleared his throat.
"Highness, the enemy's composed of what were originally mercenary companies, men who fought for pay under a hard and fast code of conduct. They've since been forged by murder, terror, and dark magic into a force unlike any that has waged war on the kingdom in history."
He looked around the room.
"Some are soldiers who've been fighting their way across half a world, from the fall of the Westlands in Nevindus to the destruction of Krondor. For 20 years they've known nothing but war, plunder, pillage, and rape."
He caught the dandy's eye and said,
"Some of them are cannibals."
The man went pale and seemed as if he might faint. Eric continued,
"They'll come at us because they have no other option. We've destroyed their fleet behind them, and they have no food. They also number some 10,000 to 20,000 Saur. We don't know the exact number."
Some of the eastern nobles looked blank at the name. For those who haven't been briefed, the Saur are lizard men, something akin to the Pantathians, but 9 feet tall. They ride war horses 25 hands at the withers, and the sound of them charging is like thunder across the mountains.
"Oh, dear gods!" said the dandy, and he rose up, holding his hand over his mouth.
He dashed from the room, and after a moment of silence, several of the lords in the room exploded into laughter. The prince laughed as well. Then, after the mirth had subsided, he said, "My lords and gentlemen, despite the levity, every word Captain von Darkmoor has uttered is true. More, if anything, he underestimates the foe."
"What are we to do?" asked another well-dressed lord, who looked as if he'd never held a sword in his life.
"My lord, we will fight. Here we stand, at Darkmoor and along Nightmare Ridge. And we will not be budged, for if the enemy passes us, the kingdom is doomed. It will be victory or death. There is no other choice." The room fell silent.